listening to a Veritex Community Bank Roadshow, live from Drift Bar. This is the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
It's Joe George and Cole Thompson here with you on the Killer Bees today till 3 o'clock on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. We are live at Drift Bar. Come hang out. Watch the Masters all weekend long during the shows today. Until 7, we've got the 97.5 Beer Bucket Special. Five domestic beers for $20 until 7 o'clock. Friday happy hour until 8. They've got the massive outdoor patio, which, you know, it's a little under the weather today. Not the best weather here in Houston, of course, but dog-friendly, good vibes, huge 250-inch screen on the south patio. It's awesome. I've been out here before on the weekends catching games and just kind of came out here during the tournament. So it's awesome. We got some it's not Papa Shot. What's the official name?
Ah, crap, I don't know. It's
just
Arcade
Basketball?
Arcade Basketball.
Arcade Basketball here, which we might have to do a little bit after the show today to see who was at the top of the class. I know we were supposed to have a pickleball match between the Wheelhouse yesterday, but it rained at the East River Nine, so that one didn't happen. But so maybe we'll do some Papa Shot.
Is pickleball now basically like the fat man's frisbee golf?
I think so.
That's why I feel like at this point.
Now, if Lance Zierlein heard that, you might get banned from the station.
Oh, God.
Because I've heard that Lance is an avid frolfer.
No, I'm saying frisbee golf is fine, but I'm saying fat man frisbee golf.
Okay.
You still got to be athletic to play frisbee golf.
But see, I've heard you have to be somewhat athletic to play pickleball. I've never played. I've never really seen it. It seems to be the rage. Joel goes on and on about how in his lifetime they cut the basketball courts in half and they made them turn into pickleball courts. So apparently, like, it's a huge rave right now. But we've been talking about our most polarizing players in this year's draft for your Houston Texans. We're going to get to some Tiger Woods stuff here at the Masters in just a second, but we got to get to B-Mac. He's back at the studio and been patiently waiting. So, B-Mac, who are your three most polarizing players in this year's draft for the Texans?
I think for me, number one, it'd be a quarterback that you don't feel comfortable starting in year one. And the top guy on that list to me is Anthony Richardson, the quarterback from Florida. He was only a one-year starter at Florida. His completion percentage was pretty low. I believe it was around 53-54%. So you're looking at a guy you can't come in and play year one, and I think that'd be very frustrating for Texans fans, especially if that means passing. It would mean passing on either Bryce Young or C.J. Stroud, whoever doesn't go at number one. It would be available to play in year one. And the other two, I think, would be chasing picks where Nick Caserio probably made a mistake last year, obviously, with cornerback. Didn't get Sauce Gardner, and then Kenyon Green kind of mixed reviews there with pick number 15 in the first round. So if you saw the Texans take an interior offensive lineman, especially if they traded back from 12 and took an interior offensive lineman, even though center and guard is a need, I think that'd be pretty upsetting for Texans fans. And then just a cornerback, you know, one year after you have questions about Derek Stingley, you chase that with another cornerback, especially like Joey Porter Jr., if people maybe have the idea that you're just chasing the name, chasing somebody that's like a second-generation NFL player, I think that would be pretty upsetting for the Texans fans as well.
B-Mac, how dare you? How dare you say that about Joey Porter Jr.? He is a stud. He is amazing.
I didn't say he wasn't talented. I'm just saying if I think it'd be frustrating because this team has so many holes on its roster that if you go into this draft and spend picks on the same positions that you spent first-round picks on last year, there's going to be a lot of questions about Nick Caserio and his team building and the fact that you'd have to spend multiple picks on the same position to get it right.
Okay, do me a favor, Texans fans out there who are listening. If you don't trust your pass rush, what's the best way to be able to go ahead and fortify a quarterback to feel pressure? It's by having a great secondary. It's by having cornerbacks that can blanket every single receiver regardless of who they're going up against. Speed, route running, ability, catch radius, all these little traits that you have for a bona fide number one. Now do me a favor. Put Joey Porter Jr., who is a physical machine, plays well in this style of defense, cover three, also great press man coverage, as your number two guy against Derek Stingley, who's going up against your number one. And you get a fully healthy year of Derek Stingley Jr., and you get a full year of having a guy who could be a bona fide number one, have that alpha dog mentality, and be a playmaker and a younger version and a better version, maybe upgrade over Steven Nelson, in Joey Porter Jr. If you don't like the pass rusher, say, at 12, or if you move back and you don't like a Lucas Van Ness, who did not start his entire college career.
No, I don't think that's fair.
No, because you're right, because Phil Parker does not like having juniors play. He only likes having seniors play. But you don't like a Miles Murphy, or you don't like a B.J. Ojulari or a Nolan Smith. Best way to do so, by keeping the quarterback under duress, have two cornerbacks. And
for sure.
I still feel like, as of this point, you look right now at next year's cornerback class, it is a weak spot. And you have Desmond King going into a contract year. You have Steven Nelson going into a contract year. One is going to be 31 next offseason, so they start to lose a little bit of that regression, especially in backpedals and in coverages. This is a guy who I view as cornerback number one in this year's class.
Interesting.
He's physical. He is great at the line of scrimmage. He loves to be able to get in your face. He is not a guy that's going to take lightly to somebody talking smack to him. And even though he won't get a lot of interceptions, guy was phenomenal at breaking up passes. He's fluid at the hip. He keeps players in front of him. He keeps receivers in the likes of his peripheral. I just love the pick. I have been clamoring for about 2 weeks now. Joey Porter Jr. in the first round should be a Houston Texan.
Yeah, like, I get why you would view it that way. I kind of side with BMAC on this one of why it would be the most. It would be super polarizing because you are admitting defeat in a way. It would feel like it doesn't mean you are, but people are not high on Nick Caserio. If this was down the road and Nick Caserio has had better success with the organization and he's gone back to back corner, like then I think people would feel better. But if you first now I know there's not an interior guard in this draft.
Well, you
that
don't
falls
need
into
one, too, because
no, I know,
you added in Shaq Mason.
But, like, let's say you didn't have Shaq Mason and you went back-to-back interior guard or back-to-back corner. I think people would feel the same way. It's like you took one last year. If you already feel like you have to take another one, people are going to be shocked by that. Now, the Stevie Nelson thing is interesting because the day after the Tunsil deal went through, he started tweeting up a storm about, I'm next, eyes emojis. Like, he was almost, like, giving off this impression that he was getting a new contract from the Houston Texans, and like I think everyone thought he was going to be, and that they were going to lock up Stevie Nelson for the next 2 or 3 years, and like that was going to be your corners. That has not happened. So I get why it's polarizing, but I also get why it makes sense of if you were to draft a corner. Personally, to me, I want the Texans to go pass rusher or wide receiver at 12 because I love JSN. I think JSN is an elite wide receiver and is going to be an elite wide receiver in the NFL. So I view him as the guy at 12 and Van Ness at 12 for me. But I just – why?
Miles Murphy would be my guy.
See, I'm not a Murphy guy.
I'm a huge Murphy guy. He is going to be the most underrated pass rusher that comes out of this year's class because if all they're going to see is his sack total. How about look at his pressure total? How about look at his tackles for losses? You were an organization last year that finished bottom five in yards after contact, bottom five against the run, and bottom five in pressure rate. So I understand where everyone's coming from. Oh, Van Ness. The guy basically is a walking Midwest guy. Like if you hear him talk, oh, don't you know, it's been a nice time to be able to hang out with
him. He's like Iowa through and through.
I am Iowa through and through. I love my corn. It's a great time. Like, he's that guy. But Miles Murphy, at some point, is going to be a steal for a team because you overthink it just like everyone did with Justin Herbert back in 2020. Oh, he came back for another year. The guy still was phenomenal. The guy still put up record numbers in the Pac-12. And I get it. The Pac-12 is nowhere near the SEC. Do you know who has the most passing yards in his first 3 years in NFL history? Justin Herbert. So it's the same thing, I think, with Miles Murphy. That's just my opinion of it.
I think both those guys would make a lot of sense personally. I'm not like anti Miles Murphy. I wouldn't say there's really any of the pass rushers at the top that I'm would be upset with the Texans if they took it 12. I view this draft really simply. You have three picks. You should draft a quarterback. And I know we're going to do this a little bit later. A quarterback, a wide receiver, and a pass rusher. However you get there, I think I'm okay with. You know, there's a bunch of different paths to getting those three spots filled, but I think they are. With where the Texans are at in the draft, those are the three best positions that you can attack.
See, LZ and I were on the same page on one thing I will say, and that is the safest prospect in this year's class, in my opinion, is Peter Skoronski, the offensive lineman from Northwestern. So if you did not add in Shaq Mason, I would immediately be like, if Skoronski is on the board, you have to take him because I feel like that he is going to be an all-pro guard, but he has tackle experience. So say you don't want to go ahead and sign Titus Howard to a long-term deal, let him walk in free agency, there's your plug-and-play right tackle. But if he is going to go ahead and sign a long-term deal, you have question marks at what you have in Kenyon Green, who was good last year in run blocking, horrendous last year in pass pro. why not go ahead and add in a guy that can fortify your offensive line for whoever is your starting quarterback? And the biggest thing that you know about San Francisco and the style of offense, the quarterback is all about completion percentage. It's all about moving the sticks. It's all about keeping plays alive, keeping turnovers off the field, and instead just trying to put yourself in position to score points. Best way to do so, protect your quarterback. And that's what you would do with a guy like Peter Skoronski.
Peter Skoronski is an interesting one because Peter Skoronski is part of the reason why I love Lucas Van Ness.
Oh, God.
Because I've watched...
Was that the game?
I watch a lot of Big Ten football, and Lucas Van Ness, the teams, like, what he did against Skoronski and Paris Johnson was really impressive. And I like both those guard/tackles. I think both those tackles are good. I think both will be good in the NFL. I'm fine with Skoronski. If, like, I don't get the idea of taking him in the top 10, personally.
Oh, I do. If he's going, him as top 5 player.
If you're going to move him inside as a guard, just because I don't think the value's there at that position. But I get why he's going to go top 10. I think he is just going to stay in Chicago and go number 9 overall. And I've got mixed feelings about it. I think it makes a lot of sense to protect Justin Fields. But, like, that's part of the reason why I like Lucas Van Ness is because, you know, he took these two guys who are, you know, most people believe are the two top tackles in the draft.
Probably two offensive linemen in the draft.
Yeah,
I'd go with that better.
And he dominated them. Like, he Lucas Van Ness absolutely dominated Paris Johnson and Peter Skoronski this year. And that's really why I do like him a lot is because, like, I'm not some deep dive draft expert. I don't pretend to be. But if you're going to tell me that these are the two best offensive linemen and there's a guy who dominated them this season and in the past seasons as well, that means something to me.
I understand that point, and I totally get it. But my other compliment would be, if you do feel like that you want to protect your quarterback in Houston, why not add in the best plug-and-play player, whoever that may be, at multiple positions? That is what smart teams do. And I feel like that there is value in a guy like Skoronski if you were to stay at 12. It's not going to happen because you add in Shaq Mason, who was phenomenal for the last few years in New England and also in Tampa Bay last season. And you're not going to give up on Kenyon Green after one season. But if you did want to go ahead and add an offensive lineman, the guy would be Peter Skoronski for me at 12.
All right, 713-780-3776. We got a bunch of texts and calls rolling in on this, so we'll get you guys on the other side. He's Cole Thompson. I'm Joe George. We are live at Drift Bar on the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
This is a Veritex Community Bank Roadshow, live from Drift Bar. This is the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Joe George and Cole Thompson in for Jeremy and Joel and the Killer Bees here on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. We're live at Drift Bar till 3. Wheelhouse will be here till 7. Got a couple texts here about off that last segment, Cole. 9198, I will go pass rusher at 2, corner at 12.
All right.
Look.
You trade up and getting Hendon Hooker, who's 25 years old.
Hard pass. I'm just going to be a Keenumite.
Would you be a Keenumite? Keonian?
Keenumite? Is that Keenumite? What you're looking for?
Is that what they called it? I couldn't
remember. It's not what you said.
I know it's not what I said. I couldn't remember what they called it. And I could not. My brain just stopped working. As long as it's not Davis Mills next year, I get the idea of trying to wait for, you know, Drake May and Caleb Williams next year, and of course there'll be a third quarterback at some point that will emerge into these conversations.
At the same time, though, we had the same conversation about Spencer Rattler and Sam Howell. What happened
exactly,
to them?
Exactly.
So you can't just expect, oh, Drake May, Caleb Williams to be bona fide superstars, because every year you see it happen.
Oh, it's going to happen. Because you know what's going to happen? If the Texans don't take a quarterback, everyone's going to say, oh, good, they're just – or a lot of people are going to say, oh, good, they're just waiting for Caleb Williams or Drake May. And then we're going to get to the draft next year, and Kate Klubnik's going to win the Heisman from Clemson and take his team to the Final Four, and people are going to say, wait for Kate Klubnik. And then we're going to do it again, and they're going to wait for Arch Manning. And it's just like no one's ever happy with the draft class. We were literally last year having these conversations about Bryce Young after his junior year winning the Heisman Trophy, getting to the college football playoff, and it was Bryce Young next year is who the Texans should take. And now we're here, and people are panicked about his size all of a sudden.
Well, the difference was also you didn't have to worry about Kenny two hands too small picket.
Yeah,
so that
guy
was probably it as well.
Definitely another someone else agrees with you, Cole. Two great cornerbacks solidifies half your defense. A great edge rusher will make the other half solid.
Someone thinks I'm smart. Thank you.
I know. We've got at least one person here. Someone sent us a mock draft. Okay, here
we go. I want to read this, actually.
All right. C.J. Stroud at 2, Quentin Johnson at 12.
Bye.
Felix You got to help
and
me.
And Dick Uzama
from Kansas State. Dude, this guy went deep.
Yeah, listen, I stopped listening after Quentin Johnson at 12. Sorry, I did.
So how do you feel? So Quentin Johnson's drop rate, 10%.
Yeah.
Hi. How do you feel about? Do you think that's fixable? Is that something that you evaluate when you go through your draft stuff, Cole? That you say, okay,
yeah, it's fixable.
This guy who can't catch, I can make him catch now. Because like Will Fuller was like that,
23% in college.
I'm a Notre Dame fan. Like Will Fuller had major hand problem, like major catching problems, and they were not great in the NFL, but they were significantly better. His hands were better in the NFL than they were in college for whatever reason. So like, I think there is an argument to be made that Quentin Johnson, like those concerns can be alleviated. It's just that's your main job is catch the football, and he had a 10% drop rate. That's pretty high.
The argument isn't that for me. The argument is what do you do that's so elite? Jack Spinajigba, amazing route runner. The guy is going to be crisper than the likes of a Lay's chip coming out of the bag. You got a guy in Jalin Hyatt. Vertical speed out the wazoo. He can take the tops off of defenses. You get a guy like a Zay Flowers. Amazing after the catch. Quentin Johnson, route running, good, not great. Hands, good, not great. Blocking, good, not great. Vertical presence, good, not great. Speed, good, not great. So if you're getting a lot of good, why take him at 12 when that's a pick that you want great? I understand trading back up to go get him. I do understand having the guy like a trade-up for the New York Giants or like the Cincinnati Bengals if he's available, say, at 28. That's the value of getting a Quentin Johnston because if you wouldn't ask him to be your number one immediately, you wouldn't ask him to be really even your number two if you get John Metchie on the field, you would ask him to be your number three and develop, and he is a developmental wide receiver like a lot of these guys are. They have a lot of good traits that will make them stars at the next level in some type of role, but he doesn't have that elite asset that is available at 12, not like a Joey Porter Jr., not like a Miles Murphy, not like your guy Lucas Van Ness. Mm-hmm. They're not guys that you would see have every one of those skill sets that comes in right away and becomes an immediate impact the way that you expect them to. So I understand taking Quentin Johnston. Everyone thinks that I hate Quentin Johnston. I love Quentin Johnston's tape. I don't love it at 12. I don't love any wide receiver at 12 outside of JSN, and he's not going to be there, in my opinion.
And here's the thing, though, where I'll push back against that, Cole, is that I do think if you draft a wide receiver at 12, they are your number one wide receiver.
But then that's the problem. There is no
for sure.
But there is no number one besides JSN in this class.
Yeah, because the problem with this team is that Metchie is a huge question mark, and the idea that Robert Woods is a good football player is a total joke to me. Like, he hasn't been a good contributor in the NFL in like 5 years.
You're so mean.
It was a waste of money. Like I think it was a terrible. I think it's by far the worst thing
for
Nick Cassara did.
For the offense that they're going to run. I like him as a fit. He's a willing blocker downfield.
Sure.
He's going to be your number three if you get Metchie and another receiver in there, which is the role that he usually played both in Los Angeles and in Buffalo. And I think that he is a very good route runner. But you do worry about the torn ACL. You do worry about the couple of drops they had last year in Tennessee, which was also due to limited quarterback play, especially when Ryan Tannehill went out. And you do worry about him at 30 years old. But I understand from a veteran standpoint why you bring him in. I would have brought in DJ Chark. That would have been the receiver I would have targeted. But if you're going to bring in a guy, I understand why you have a player like Robert Woods. The
for
offense
sure.
fits for a guy like Robert Woods.
Yeah, here. It definitely makes sense. All right, so the Masters obviously going on right now. Coverage is partially underway. We're live here at Drift Bar. You can come watch it all weekend long. And so yesterday on the Killer Bees, Jeremy brought up this discussion. He got a lot of flack for it on social media. He called Tiger Woods average, which I think is obvious at this point. He's outside the top 1,000 golfers
when
in the world.
When you nearly
right now.
Amputate your leg, I think average is a fine number.
For sure.
I think it's a like, fine way to talk about
but,
somebody.
But you know, the question, you know, yesterday was kind of like, has there ever been someone we're as intrigued by, as invested in, that's as average at their sport as Tiger is right now? Because Tiger Woods is on TV. We all want to watch. But kind of bouncing off of that, I was thinking about Tiger Woods and just like what he's doing now. But when you think back to what it was in its peak, how elite he was, what the ratings were for golf, what the money was for golf, for other players, for himself on tour, have we ever seen a player in any sport, individual, team sport, whatever, that was more impactful to the day-to-day of that sport than Tiger Woods?
As impactful?
Or even, is anyone even close? Is anyone in that stratosphere of Tiger Woods for their sport? Because to me, I think the answer is no in the NFL.
No.
Because Tom Brady, yes, while he was great, You could have removed Tom Brady from any season, and you still had Drew Brees and Peyton Manning and all these big and all big time players like
Philip Rivers, Ben Roethlisberger. You still had Carson Palmer at one point, who was expected to be great. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't change.
LeBron, and I think LeBron, Kobe, and Michael are interesting, like to their eras. You know, because we saw what happened when Michael retired. The NBA really struggled with ratings. Like, it wasn't a great product. There wasn't that superstar yet as Kobe was kind of developing into his own. And then, you know, LeBron and Kobe had that overlap. So, like, I think maybe you could put those guys
in
that category.
I got one. Shaq. I put Shaq in there because Shaq was so dominant around the rim. He was so physical. And the fact that he broke backboards like no one's business. They had to change the way they made backboards. And there's been a conversation about, like, how could a guy such as, I don't know, maybe Draymond Green, I think, was the one that brought this up. If I was going up against Shaq today, I'd be able to kick his ass. No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't be able to do it in the 1990s either because the rules were so different back then that it allowed him just to basically physically dismantle you down low. So I just think that a guy like Shaq changed the way of how you play basketball because of the equipment that you use in basketball.
Yeah, I honestly can't even tell where this is going. Dylan from Twitch, he says Dale Earnhardt Jr. was definitely not as good as surviving. I don't know.
Nope.
Yep, I read it all the way through, I realized where it was going. So,
Joe, keep your eyes on the last word first before you read the whole thing.
Dylan got me there because I thought we were going to get a Dale Earnhardt in NASCAR comparison to Tiger Woods, which probably would be fair, but that's not my sport, so I can't say. I was going to throw Conor McGregor out.
That was my guy. That was my guy, 100%.
Because while there was good players in the UFC, or good athletes in the UFC, good fighters, there wasn't, like, that transcendent star. Like, I mean, George St. Pierre, to me, like, was a big one. But, like, he didn't translate. He didn't build as much as Conor. So I think Conor's kind of in that category, but he was such a short-lived time compared to Tiger.
Yeah, and here's the main reason why. Because if he was able to be big on social media, and I think social media made UFC that much more profitable, it made it that much more invigorating. The fact that he was willing to go out of his way to talk smack against every single person on social, he'd make videos challenging somebody in the ring, he'd do the double champ, I have to apologize to absolutely nobody. That was what made UFC so popular, because if he was just the biggest mouth, and he loved to be able to back it up. And that was the thing. Because if he didn't back it up, no one would care. No one would care that he was running around like crazy, being somebody who had to go ahead and be boastful about what he did back in 2013, but then he backed it up. And when you back it up, you're allowed to go ahead and talk your smack as long as possible. It's like going back to the whole thing, and I don't want to bring this up because of, you know, it's well past it, but Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark. Like, both of them backed it up on the court. Allow them to talk their smack because they both did what they needed to do to prove why they were able to be dominant and be the alphas. So Conor McGregor did the same thing. I don't want to take the cop-out answer with Jackie Robinson because Jackie Robinson changed the game of baseball because if he broke the color barrier. I feel like that if you were one person that broke maybe the color barrier, didn't really break it, but expanded on minority athletes, black athletes to be able to have a voice, it was Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali in boxing changed the way. And even when he was getting older and was starting to get CTE because of all the blows he took to the head, I was paying attention to it. I think everybody back then was paying attention to it. And I think Mike Tyson falls in that category.
Yeah, Tyson was another one.
Because Tyson versus Ali, Ali was still on radio at the time where Tyson was on television. So it was like one of those things where broadcasting got so much bigger that you were vigorously invested in seeing a guy like Mike Tyson in the ring. And you could hear it on radio, but you also could watch it and you could see the blows. You didn't have to read about it in the newspaper on a Sunday morning. You got to see it unfold live. Your eyes got to pay attention to what Mike Tyson did.
3515 says Andre Agassi. I don't know. Sure.
Yeah, no, Andre Agassi, 100%. John McEnroe in tennis, same thing. Crap talker. Like, literally would break rackets because he got a wrong call. So it's one of those things where if you back it up, yeah, I understand it.
I love this one from 2128. Gretzky is about the only NHL player I can name, so he must have been transcendent.
Yarmir Yager played forever that his knees blew out.
You can't say Yager is like a...
No, he's not, but I'm just saying that's a hockey player I can name.
That's a good point. You can name another hockey player.
I can name multiple hockey players. My dad grew up in Chicago, so it's like I better know the Blackhawks.
That's very true. Gretzky, I do feel like you probably kind of put him in that category of someone of how impactful they were to their sport, because he was such a superstar off the ice as well. So that's an interesting one. I've really been trying to, like, think of an NFL player that just,
there's
like,
none.
There's just none.
There's
they just
none.
Don't matter. Like, the team matters so much more.
Because of, as much as I would love to say, like, a Barry Sanders or a Walter Payton, back then it was a predicated run offense. So you expected them to have that type of impact. And I would say, yeah, you could maybe throw Peyton Manning into the mix because if he was Mr. Fundamental. But you also had John Elway before him being the exact same type of guy. So every year we have, like, these conversations of generational talent. Generational talent. First off, there is no such thing as a generational talent, people. It's all about how you progress. You may be a generational prospect, but you may not be a generational talent because of you see players every single year in every single sport fail to meet expectations. So if that's the way that they are, then they're not generational. But I feel like maybe Bo Jackson would be one only because of the fact that he played two different sports.
Yeah, him in Primetime.
Primetime as well. Well, Primetime also just was willing to run his mouth and not care who he went up against.
Yeah, Primetime was just
like do you remember the draft story? Hey, the Giants are picking at number 7. Maybe we're going to bring you in for a workout. No, you're not. I'm not going to be there at number 7, so don't even waste my time.
Yeah, it's Primetime. And now he's doing it at Colorado, honestly. Like, what he means to Colorado. I was actually going to throw, I know we said player. But I feel like Nick Saban kind of falls into this category a little bit, like as like just someone that like how much they matter to their sport because like just he's just how much he's dominated on a day in and day out basis for so long. Like outside of that for college football, like it just it'd be so individualized. Like you would call like Tim Tebow if you lived in Florida, like
yeah,
that player. Like you would say like Tim Tebow is that guy that like he changed. He, like, revamped Florida football, and, I mean, they're kind of a disaster.
Johnny Manziel can tweet something, and you get an article about it 30 minutes later. Like, it's the same thing. Like,
yeah.
They're transcendent because of their personalities. One was basically the party boy, and one was basically St. Jesus.
Yeah,
like, that
for
was
sure.
What it was.
Yeah, absolutely. He's Cole Thompson. I'm Joe George. It's the Killer Bees filling in with you here until 3 o'clock at Drift on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Coming up next, let's get into some Rocket stuff because it is rumor season. With just a handful of games left, the future of Rafael Stone and Steven Silas have been reported. We'll hit on that next year on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Live from Drift Bar for a Veritex Community Bank Roadshow, this is the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Joe George and Cole Thompson filling in for Joel and Jeremy today here live at Drift. We're here till 3 o'clock. Wheelhouse here till 7. Come out and get the 97.5 beer bucket special. 5 domestic beers for $20 all throughout the broadcast. Watch the Masters all weekend. We got happy hour until 8 o'clock here at Drift because it is a Friday. So come out, enjoy your weekend, get it started here at Drift. Come watch the Masters and come hang out with us, ESPN 97.5. So, we all knew that like we were going to get reports eventually of what's going on with the Rockets. You know, a lot of it's inevitable. Steven Silas at the last home game openly just talked about how it's his 3-year contract is up. It's, you know, his last home game under that 3-year contract. That kind of solves the mystery of what's next for him. You know, he said he hadn't talked to Rafael Stone about his future. So I think we all kind of got the writing on the wall at that point. Today, Yahoo Sports reported that his contract won't be renewed, so duh. So Steven Silas will not be back as the Rockets head coach. The real question, I think, was what's going to happen with Rafael Stone? And Jonathan Fagan wrote a story for the Chronicle yesterday, and he said, quote, General Manager Rafael Stone is certain to lead the next steps despite rumors that have been planted in recent months and picked up through Final Four weekend. So Rafael Stone is going to be back, it sounds like. Obviously, nothing official yet. We could see a change. I do think personally that Rafael Stone's future is not set in stone. And I think that it kind of just depends on the direction that this franchise heads. If they decide they're going to continue through the rebuild, then maybe they'll stick with them. I think if they're going to be a more aggressive approach, I could see Tillman Fertitta wanting to go in a different direction. But at this point, it seems like Rafael Stone's back. Steven Silas is gone. And I'm going to be honest, I don't really get it. Like, I don't really get why Rafael Stone is going to be back as a general manager of the Rockets. What he's done to deserve it. These players have not developed. He could have fired Steven Silas at any point in time. when they went from a team that was built to win, which was Silas was hired for, and it's been a disaster since. Kevin Porter Jr. has been an issue on and off the court for the last 3 years. These guys are not developing. They're not developing quickly. When it does look like they're developing like Jalen Green, then it looks like they regress. And it just seems like this organization doesn't really have a direction of where they're going. We have the John Wall stuff. Everyone knows this organization is just in a bad spot. So why they're not cleaning house, I just don't really understand.
My big thing isn't even that. My big thing is that when you are a rebuilding franchise, and I always try to give enough respect to any franchise that is going through a rebuild, I don't care about wins. I care about production. Are you becoming a better shooter? Are you becoming better with the three-pointer? Are you getting better at the rebounding? Are you getting better with your field goal percentage? Are you getting better when it comes to assist? Are you building chemistry? There's none of that right now. There's absolutely none of that. Yeah, Jalen Green's a fine player, but he isn't developing it the same way as a Josh Giddey. He isn't developing as other players who were drafted after him. Yeah, Jabari Smith Jr., you like him for your future. Do you think that he can be a number one? Do you think he can play with Jalen Green, or was it a wash of a pick? Right now, the best pick for this team has been Şengün. Şengün has been the guy. And if you think that Şengün is the guy, that's fine, and I'm all for it, but you have to be able to land those players when you get those top-tier lottery picks. And there's no chemistry. You still rank bottom three in shooting. You've gotten worse since last year in shooting when adding in Jabari Smith. You've gotten worse in rebounds. You've gotten worse in assists. You've gotten worse in turnovers. You've gotten worse in every single statistical category. So when you are a rebuilding team and your production is diminishing instead of improving, it's hard for me to buy into anything that the GM, the coach, or anybody internally that has a say in the building besides the owner is selling right now.
Yeah.
And it's like goes back to the Nick Caserio thing. I understand why Nick Caserio gets another year in Houston. I get it. I know that people are against it. But Nick Caserio has won 11 games. If D'Amico Ryans wants to say on a six-year contract, if you are the likes of Cal McNair, you give the word to Caserio, you give the word to D'Amico. Because D'Amico is going to be here well after you're gone if you fail to go over 6 wins this year. 11 wins is not sustainable for any team. It's not sustainable for when you go into a third coaching search. It's not sustainable for when your offensive production diminishes and your defensive production doesn't get any better either. So it goes back to the same thing with Rafael Stone. I understand why you want to give him another year. But if you want somebody else to have the final say, if you want the next coach to come in and say, I like this player in free agency, let's go ahead and add him. Stone, you better add him, because if he may be here longer than you will.
Yeah, see, this is my problem with that, is that, and it's just an overall philosophical thing. I don't think what the Texans did was right, and I don't think what the Rockets are going to do here is right. I do not believe that you should have a general manager and a head coach not aligned. Because while you might be aligned for a year, you know, if Stone hires a new head coach, let's say he hires Nick Nurse or Udoka, and after a year they don't get along and that guy's out, well, now you've got another GM. But it's Rafael Stone, who, let's say you don't win the lottery and you get the second pick, is going to have to make the decision between Scoot Henderson and Brandon Miller. It's the same thing with Nick Caserio. If Nick Caserio, if Cal McNair is not happy and they want to get rid of Caserio after a year, but you let Nick Caserio make your decision at quarterback. Because then you've got a coach who they didn't select, and they selected the players that the new GM has to deal with. And all it does is it seems like it leads to problems. So like that to me is where they're making a mistake here with the Rockets, is you should just clean house. Just get rid of Stone and get rid of Silas. Because Silas was his decision. So he failed. He could have fired him before. Now I know maybe Tillman Fertitta does not believe, and it's early on in his tenure as, you know, as a an owner in the NBA. And this will be his third head coach. This is the second time, instead of firing a coach, they're just going to wait until he has any guaranteed money contract, any guaranteed money left on his contract. So maybe that's their philosophy, and it's not my money, so I can't say it's the wrong approach. But I just think they should be resetting the entire market within the building. Get a new GM. Get a new coach, and because then as an organization, you can decide to move forward if you believe in Jalen Green, if you believe in Jabari Smith, if you believe in Şengün.
Because like, Şengün's not going anywhere.
Because like, I mean, honest, I don't believe in Şengün. I think he's an incredibly talented player on offense, but to me, he is no different than when you look like what's been happening in the NBA the last 3 years, when in the playoffs, Nikola Jokic is a liability for his defense. They have to... He's not beneficial to his team at times in the playoffs. Rudy Gobert, even though he's supposed to be a great defensive player, is basically useless. And, like, that's just my concern with Şengün, is that he's too slow, that in today's modern NBA, while his offense is great, his defense is just not going to be where it needs to be by the time you need to win. Well, it's not that I don't think he's a good player. I just think in the long term, like, I just don't view that position and the way he plays it as valuable.
Look, again, it goes back to what you want to do with your next coach. If your next coach wants a certain player, then that's who you have to bring in. If your next coach wants to draft a certain guy very early on, that's who you have to bring in. Because at the end of the day, they're the one that's going to be here when you're gone. And you go look at the whole Caserio thing, I don't even really care what D'Amico Ryans wants at quarterback. I don't care what Bobby Slowick wants at quarterback.
Yeah.
Because if he is your offensive coordinator for 2 years, he is going to be exactly what you like for your future. He's the guy that can develop your quarterback. It goes back to the whole, like, Josh Allen comp. Like, Josh Allen had a horrendous offensive coordinator for a year. They bring in Brian Daboll. Daboll says, okay, we're going to take out all the negatives of your game. We're only going to focus in on the positives. We're going to hone in on that first. And then if you get that guy and you get the player that we think you're going to be, we'll eventually keep work out your negatives. It's the same thing when you get a coach in there. The coach gets final say if they're on a new contract. It's not about the GM anymore. So if a new coach also does not like a Şengün, go ahead and trade him. If a new coach does not like Jalen Green, go ahead and trade him. I don't think that you would be able to have that. I don't think that that's what they're going to do. But I do think that if a new coach does have a certain philosophy, you got to listen to him. He has final say because at the end of the day, he's the one that you're banking on for the next 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. You're banking on D'Amico Ryans for the next 4, 5, 6 years to bring your franchise back to stability. You're not banking on Nick Caserio. If Caserio has a bad year, okay, bygone. Thanks for everything. Don't worry about it. Don't let the door hit you. It's that way.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's his job, though, is to evaluate these prospects like that. Like, D'Amico's not really, you know, he's not grinding on tape the way Caserio is. Now, he is now, but he doesn't have, like, the long-term view because he's obviously worried about trying to win a Super Bowl with the 49ers. Same thing with, like, you know, a Nick Nurse. Like, if it comes down to Scoot Henderson and Brandon Miller because you get the second pick, it's like that guy is focusing on trying to get the Toronto Raptors in the playoffs, not focus on what's next for the team. So it's a balance for sure. And I definitely think you're right. Like the new coach has to have a lot of say. I personally think they're making a mistake.
Because they're here longer.
Yeah, I think the Rockets are making a mistake by keeping Rafael Stone and I don't think it's a mistake to get rid of Steven Silas. I think that's very clear. The players did not respond to him. I do think personally that what happened to Steven Silas is not necessarily a reflection of him. It is a reflection of what the NBA is today in dealing with children that are immature and told. It's not just Jalen Green. It's not just Jabari Smith. Like, I think you're seeing a lot of guys coming to the NBA right now that it's taking them a lot of time to get ready and become pros because, I mean, 60% of the Rockets team can't legally drink alcohol. So it's like they're young kids, and you have to develop them. So I'm hopeful that, you know, they're going to bring in a veteran coach that can help them go into the next part of the Rockets' future. He's Cole Thompson. I'm Joe George. It's the Killer Bees live from Drift on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Live from Drift Bar for a Veritex Community Bank Roadshow. This is the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Joe George and Cole Thompson in for Joel and Jeremy today. They're off for Good Friday. We're live at Drift. You can catch us on Twitter at Joe George Radio, at Mr. Cole Thompson, at Sack by BMAC, Brian McDonald back in the studio, and at Carlson Radio, Andrew Carlson, our on-site engineer today. Just going back to this GM conversation, when you look at, you know, like where the organizations are at, it is an interesting time. You've got two GMs who have probably failed in Caserio and Stone who are keeping their job, and then you have this ultimate unknown in Dana Brown, who, like, everyone thinks it's going to be, you know, a great hire for the Astros. I think there's a lot – to me, it's not as much of a lock as I think people wanted to make it seem. But then, like, the coaches, you have a bunch of question marks as well. So let's fast forward a little bit here. It's 2024. Is Nick Caserio your GM, you think?
How many wins? Because that's the main point. How many wins?
See, I don't think wins matter.
But I think it does outside of you can't have three. I think you have to be around six.
What if
Okay, I'll listen to it. But
what if you have? What if you're awful again next year, record wise?
Which I think that they still will be pretty bad.
But you see the development. Like let's say you draft Bryce Young. Like all you, I think we'll just compare with Chicago in a way. Justin Fields, I think for a lot of people, had an awful year. I disagree. I think he played fine.
What, last year?
Yeah.
He was fine. He's not top two like some people are putting in the NFC rankings, but yeah, he's fine.
Well, I think that's a reflection because how bad the NFC is. But let's say Bryce Young, Derek Stingley Jr., Kenyon Green, you know, these guys play better this year. Like, you see it on the field. Like, okay, there's talent on the Texans roster, but it just doesn't translate to wins. I think you can still be a 2 or 3 win team and Casera can keep his job. Because you can see that, like, he's got it right in the draft. There's just still some work to do. I think there's a path to that happening. I think it's the least likely scenario. So let's call it 6 wins. Bryce Young or C.J. Stroud plays as expected as a rookie. Does Nick Casario still have his job?
At the point of where you're getting these free agents to come in, I think it's a big deal. Because if this was the offseason where at least you started to get a little more competent at making free agent moves. Getting a guy like a Dalton Schultz, getting a guy like a Devin Singletary, trading for a Shaq Mason, getting somebody who you really do like as a Jimmy Ward who fits this defense, Sheldon Rankins, $10.5 million. Are they producing at their value of what you paid them?
Sure.
Because I thought that this was a weak free agent class. I really did. I did not think that outside of Javon Hargrave, who wasn't coming to Houston, Daron Payne, who wasn't coming to Houston, and Jesse Bates, who wasn't coming to Houston, was a very pretty overall lackluster free agent class. So based off what you have in terms of how much you paid for these players, that to me I think is going to be a deal breaker as well.
Yeah,
especially because
that's fair.
You have all these 1 year deals. So even if they are bust, why didn't you want to spend more money on maybe a player who you see like a DJ Chark? Say he has a phenomenal year in Carolina this year. 55 catches, 795 yards, averages like 13.5 yards, 7 touchdowns. Why don't you think right now he'd be a better fit for you when you paid for Robert Woods 2 years, $17.5 million, and he has 43 catches, 444 yards. So that to me is part of it, because if you'd rather spend money on different free agents that maybe fit an offense a little bit better or are seeing better production, that's always going to be a question mark. And at the same time, I'm not going to be okay with you saying, oh, these rookies that we added in this year aren't developing. Oh, give it another year. You don't have another year. You don't if you're a GM, because if you go, you have 7 wins in 2 years. You have 2 head coaches that you fired, and whether or not it was justifiable, you still fired them. So you have to be able to show me more production, not just in free agency, not just in the draft, but I need to be able to see the development, because if these are a lot of developmental players. The one thing about this year's draft that I don't think enough people are talking about is that there's about 8 or 9 blue chip, really solid, immediate factor players that will fit in any style of offense, any style of defense. Everyone else is scheme fit. So you have to make sure you're getting the right players for your scheme to develop right away. Because if I do feel like that in this year's class where you can't get, he'll pan out if we go ahead and put him from a man to a zone coverage. Or, if we move him inside, he'll be fine. No, you know what their roles are. They fit certain criteria. So if you fail to bring in those people, nothing is going to work.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That's going to be the big question, I think, is fit versus talent with this team. Like, did Nick Casario identify, you know, through free agency guys that can come in, make an impact right away? And also, like, I'll be honest, like, I would hold it against him if Dalton Schultz is awesome this year. Like, if I was Cal McNair and Dalton Schultz has a really good year this year, I would hold it against him that he only signed into a 1 year deal. Same thing with Sheldon Rankins. Like, if these guys are going to end up having to get paid more next offseason, you at least identify them to pay them a decent chunk of change to come in and be on this team for this season. But why didn't you think they could be, like, why didn't you believe in them enough to sign them long term? So Nick Casario's offseason has been fine for me. Like, I'm glad they didn't go try to spend a bunch of money and go after, like, a Jesse Bates would be awesome. But, like, frankly, like, to me, it's so unnecessary.
No, I wouldn't.
With where you're at as a franchise, like, it's just, you don't need a guy like that. So
$60 million for a safety when you're going to be about a 5-win team? No.
Yeah, that's just a lot of money. I don't know if I'd ever pay a safety that much money.
My big thing is that I understand why the 1 year deals happen, because the one thing that does work in San Francisco, and I think that D'Amico can understand this, what does San Francisco have every single year in the draft? Compensation picks. Because they allow players to walk, they get more draft capital, and they bring in players that they think fit their system better. So I understand why you give out all these 1 year deals. But at the same time, you do have to bank on the players that you're bringing in to replace the production that you're losing. So if you do get a guy like a Siaka Ika, the defensive lineman from Baylor, and he does go toe-to-toe with someone like, I don't know, a Sheldon Rankins, does his production match enough to where when you let Rankins walk in free agency, you feel comfortable with the guy behind him stepping up? The same thing for Dalton Schultz. I really like Zach Kuntz, the tight end from Old Dominion. Phenomenal pro day, really good size, great route runner, overall solid hands. Does his production translate to the NFL fast enough to where if Dalton Schultz wants to leave in free agency, you have a plug-and-play player right away to where you can get another player with that compensation pick? Those are things that I think you have to look at when it comes to getting these type of talents.
So Nick Caserio, what do you think he'll be the GM in 2024?
Nick Caserio, as of now, I will hesitantly lean yes.
I think that's where I lean
too. I will hesitantly lean yes.
Who do you think will be the next Rockets head coach? I think it's going to be Udoka.
I think Nick Nurse.
Yeah, see,
I think it's Nick Nurse.
Part of me is just like, I really don't get why Toronto's moving on. Like, I don't really get it. Like, I know that, like, he won a title, and then it hasn't been great since. Like,
because of the development of players, probably.
But then why would you want him here?
I think that at this point, because if he's been around the block, he's been able to kind of sell the franchise, what you would do is if you're taking what Stone says about bringing in veteran talent, do people gravitate towards a guy like Nick Nurse well enough to where you would say, oh, I want to go play for this guy?
You know what's interesting, too? I do think the NBA is the exact opposite of the NFL in terms of coaching, where, like, a lot of times in the NFL you see a coach fail once and then they have a hard time getting that second job. I think in the NBA you're seeing a trend where coaches are having much more success their second time around.
Because nobody wants to take a risk on a young
guy.
Exactly. Nobody wants to take that risk. You want to just go ahead and say,
yeah,
I already know what I have. Think about this for a second. Billy Donovan. Billy Donovan is now coaching with the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah.
Do you think he's that much better than what he was when he was in Oklahoma City?
No.
No, but again, you know what you're getting. You don't want to take that risk as a franchise.
Yeah, it's also the NBA coaching cycle's weird because, like, they don't have, like, those, like, D'Amico Ryans, Shane Steichens out there. Like, you just don't know the names. Like, if anyone tells you that they, like, really knew who Steven Silas was, besides the fact that his dad was an NBA coach, pretty much 80% of the time, if not higher, they're lying to you. Because no one knows who NBA coaches are, assistant coaches are,
no,
unless
they're
former players.
I knew who Mike Brown was because he was a former head coach.
Exactly.
That's the reason. Because if you know that these coaches are going to get another opportunity, even if they have to sit a year as an assistant.
All right, one more for just looking into the future here. We're talking about the future of these franchises. We know Dana Brown's going to be here.
Yeah.
Who do you guys think's the next manager of the Astros?
I pay $1 million. I pay whatever he wants to go get Kevin Cash. I pay whatever you want to go get Kevin Cash from Tampa Bay.
Yeah, I'm just officially like we started kind of dipping into this yesterday with Jeremy and I. I'm officially on the record that I think AJ Hinch is going to be the next manager of the Astros.
I'd be fine with it. I would be,
and I know it's probably a really hot take, but I think AJ Hinch is going to be the next manager.
He's not, but I'd be fine with it.
He's a free agent.
I understand. I just don't think he is.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Hinch or Espada.
I mean Espada. All right. Fine. The way that he coaches and the way that he develops talent and the way that he's been able to keep a team that ranks bottom five in payroll every single year in the postseason contention, imagine giving Kevin Cash this lineup. I just would pay it. I really would. If you want to stay relevant and as dominant as you are, go ahead and pay for the coach that you think is going to transcend your team. It's what Houston did. Why not do the exact same thing with the Astros? Kevin Cash is the best manager in baseball that no one talks about.
Yeah, I think that would be an interesting name. I mean, look, the Astros, it's going to be – it's wild that they could go back to the World Series this year and they'll be on their third GM and their third manager going into next season. Because I do think there's – I think Dusty retires at the end of this one for
probably.
Sure. Yeah, he's Cole Thompson. I'm Joe George. Brian McDonald producing back in the studio. And next it's time for Who Said It. Cole and I will do this together for the first time. This will be my second time doing this on this side instead of reading the quotes off. So Who Said It, everyone's favorite game, is next here on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.